You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
This was set up by the Democrats. There is no collusion between me and my campaign and the Russians.
There are those that think otherwise. Unhappily for President Donald Trump, it looks more and more like one of them is the guy investigating collusion between his campaign and the Russians. My guests Stephanie Bolson and James Rogers will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including May Day riots in Paris, a channeling of the spirit of 68, or just an excuse for a punch-up, how big a 200th birthday party does Karl Marx really deserve, and President Emmanuel Macron misspeaks about the wife of Australia's Prime Minister, or did he? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Stephanie Bolton, London correspondent for Die Welt, and James Rogers, head of international journalism studies at City University here in London. Welcome both, and we start in Washington, D.C., where once again the President of the United States has been reacting to suggestions that he might have obstructed justice by threatening to obstruct justice. At some point, he typed into his phone with his tiny orange thumbs earlier today, "I will have no choice but to use the powers granted to the presidency and get involved." He appears to be still reacting to this week's leak to the New York Times of the question special counsel Robert Mueller wants to ask him. An editorial in the Times today notes that a prosecutor as good as Mueller is unlikely to ask questions to which he does not already know the answers. James, first of all, it is always hard to tell what is actually going on in that head of his, but does President Trump appear unusually rattled?
I think he probably is. I mean, it's very interesting to read the New York Times editorial as well, because we're witnessing here the clash between forensic legal mind and the sort of Twitter tendency to say the first thing that comes into your head as well. And the editorial is very strong as well. This is also, you know, the New York Times prides itself on its tradition of journalistic objectivity, its commitment to truth, and they're saying Mr. Trump has a marked tendency to say things that aren't true. So I think this is going to be a pretty blunt assessment there.
But it's still phrased in that wonderfully lofty New York
Indeed,
Times
exactly,
language,
isn't it? Just, exactly, yeah. So, but I think it is going to be very interesting to see what happens. But I think Mr. Trump probably is concerned because, of course, no doubt, you know, as you pointed out in your introduction, you know, the best lawyer never asks a question to which he or she does not know the answer first. And I imagine Mr. Mueller's working very much along those lines.
We did some time ago have on one of our programmes Robert Mueller's former deputy director at the FBI, who didn't give away terribly much, but did sort of convey the general impression, Stephanie, that Robert Mueller is pretty much the last guy in the world you want going through your bins looking for things you are hoping that nobody's going to find. There is this conventional wisdom in the narrative about Robert Mueller's probity and diligence, the suggestion that he is the right man for the job. Do we have any reason not to believe that? This editorial that we're talking about in the Times was a fairly forthright declaration of faith in the special counsel.
Yes, and rightly so. But saying all that, I must say, this has been dragging on for so long, and you've given up the faith that this next hearing will change anything. And I can't really see that there will be an outcome of this. It's just another chapter of the very long ongoing Trump-Mueller story. And I would be surprised if he were proven wrong that this will change anything. I mean, at the end of the day, what should be the outcome is my question. What should be the outcome of this?
What do you think, James? I mean, do you get the impression, because Trump's suggestion is, of course, and those close to Trump, you know, continue to assert that this is basically a fishing expedition, is the phrase. Does there have to come an end point to this, or is this just one of those things where you would hope that the investigator is taking his time and making absolutely sure everything's nailed down?
I think possibly the latter. I mean, I do share Stephanie's observation about this has gone on for a rather long time, and you do wonder when something concrete is going to come out of it.
But there have been indictments and, you know, confessions, and it's not been entirely without result.
No, not at all, not at all. And I think, you know, the questions will be very telling. I mean, wouldn't we all love to know the answers to them, whether we'll actually hear them in the same way that, you know, we've seen the questions is another matter. But I think that the relationship between Mr. Trump and certain members of his campaign team and what they may or may not have known about their relationship with Russian officials, what may or may not have gone on at meetings with Russian officials, what may or may not have gone on Mr. Trump's now infamous visit to Moscow a few years ago, all these that may well have further political repercussions, this investigation could shed light on what some of those might be.
Stephanie, if we assume that the questions in these, well, these leaked documents are genuine, that they are a reasonable approximation of the questions that Robert Mueller wishes to put to the president, is there any imaginable way that we can see Trump actually getting through those questions without dropping himself in very hot soup at some point?
No, apparently not, at least according to the judgment of the New York Times. It's quite dangerous for him. It will be very difficult for him to get away with it, because he, until now, he always got away with it through Twitter or whatever was his tactics. But this is now, it might nail him down, and it will be very difficult for him to get out of this. And if he's able of openly lie, this is proven to be lying.
This is where the crunch could come, of course, because as you point out, his usual recourse to get through most difficulties is just through bluster and chaff and distraction and making a noise. But you can't lie to a federal investigator.
You would hope so, but my faith again in everything that's happening on the other side of the Atlantic has completely vanished.
Mm. I mean, James, there is some suggestion that if push were to come to shove, if he either volunteered to speak to Robert Mueller or was subpoenaed by Robert Mueller, that he might actually plead the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer questions for fear of incriminating himself.
Well,
granted that he has contradicted pretty much every law of politics up until this point, but as President of the United States, can you really take the Fifth?
Well, that's what we'll have to see. I mean, I think sometimes Mr. Trump forgets that he is president. I mean, I think in some ways he became king when he won the election, really. And just the tweet you mentioned earlier, Andrew, you know, very much suggests that somebody who's, you know, OK, now that I'm the boss, I'm going to have to get on and deal with this in the way that only the boss can. So I think one thing, I think it's very hard to see him getting through those 49 questions without losing his temper, that's for sure.
I mean, Stephanie, is it possible, and this is my own pet theory, that President Trump really simply doesn't know whether he's broken the law or not, and wouldn't understand if he had and somebody explained to him how?
I think there's, as James just said, he has a very special perception of what is true and what is not true, of what is the law and what is not the law, and what you can do and what you can't do. And so he considers himself as a businessman. I mean, I just had a breaking news that somebody else has been fired and somebody else has come in. So the White House has become a big company. It's his corporate, and he does whatever he likes, and he doesn't think he needs to play to the rules.
This is one of his lawyers, Ty Cobb, I think I'm right in saying, who's the one with the curled up moustache.
Right.
Which is
lost track.
I'm not really sure what this costs Trump's legal team in terms of actual expertise, but it does. It's a sad day for facial hair, I think it's fair to say. We should move on and look at Paris, where they are busy tidying up after an unusually lively May Day. More than 100 people were arrested after what began as protests against the public sector labour reforms of President Emmanuel Macron escalated into riot, in which dozens of cars and businesses were vandalised and or burned. The violence has been attributed to hooded anarchist types and has caused some wistful reminiscence of the events of 50 years previously, in which students wanging paving stones at gendarmes grew into a nationwide revolt, which very nearly toppled Charles de Gaulle, no less. Stephanie, first of all, I don't wish to sound glib because people lost, you know, businesses, premises, cars, and there are a lot of people who will be aggrieved and annoyed and out of pocket this morning. But is this really, you know, a riot in Paris in and of itself that big a deal?
I was interested in hearing that it was such a riot in Paris, because we used to have a lot of riots and severe riots in Berlin every 1st of May. And so this morning, I got the morning email from my colleagues in Berlin, and they said it was the quietest night ever. in Berlin,
I did see on a German website earlier a sort of gloriously German headline that just said, no riots in Berlin.
Yes, and that really comes as a surprise. I mean, our publishing house is in Kreuzberg, and I remember when I was still working there, looking from the 15th floor onto the street, thinking, how will I get out of here tonight? And actually, we always had protection to get out in the night of the 1st of May. But what was the reason, apparently, why there weren't many clashes in Berlin, that the police has completely changed their tactics? And one thing is that they don't use water cannons anymore. They don't use confrontations with the protesters, which was what happened in Paris. There was a real violent confrontation, water cannons. And then people get also hit and injured who have nothing to do with all that. And that makes people very angry.
I mean, you're right about the culture of Parisian policing. I did a story for The Face, God rest it, in 1998, I think, where they sent me to Paris to write a piece about May 68, 30 years on. And the idea was that we would get into the spirit of it by going out demonstrating for the weekend, because you can always do that in Paris. But it was the first reaction of the CRS in particular was not to sort of ask anybody nicely. It was to sort of give everybody 10 seconds to clear the streets and then sort of steam in with clubs and tear gas, which struck me as an overreaction, frankly, in a couple of cases. But James, in Paris in particular, I mean, it's sort of what they do, isn't it?
It is, I think. I mean, I spent a year in Paris as a student in 1986, actually, when there were big education reforms, which brought a lot of people onto the streets. And having had a fairly sheltered upbringing thus far, it's the first time I ever smelt tear gas, in fact. And it was also the year which made me want to be a journalist, but that's another story. But it was, but because of the echo there, and of course, by then, when I was there, a lot of the protesters from 1968 were then in education, teachers in the high school where I was teaching English, and a lot of them were greatly inspired by it, and a lot of them were very much involved by it, and people were intrigued by the fact that 68 and 86 the numbers were reversed. But it is, and again, you know, as a journalist later on, I covered a big wave of industrial unrest in the mid-90s as well, but this is just, you know, it's a very, very important part of French politics, and Mr. Macron must have known this when he embarked on his reform campaign. You know, the railway workers famously are often out, you know, among the first to go on strike, very strongly union. One of the things they're looking at losing under this reform is the right to retire at 50, which is obviously, in their view, hard won and not something they want to give up readily. So I think we're probably going to see some more of this, because this is a very, very normal part of French politics when unpopular reforms, or at least those reforms which are unpopular with certain sections of the population, are introduced.
I mean, Stephanie, as James suggests, you could pretty much set your calendar, if not your watch, by the idea of there being some sort of dust-up in Paris on May Day. That being the case, was it wise for Macron to be out of the country? Does that make him look a little bit like Charles de Gaulle fleeing Paris at the height of May 68?
Yes, I can imagine, especially as he just came back from seeing Donald Trump, where he was by many French people seeing as... Well, I better don't use that word now in American English, but the French people were not very happy about what they were seeing, how good buddies he was with Donald Trump, and now he was then off to Australia. And these are very profound reforms he tries to get through. And in the end, it's not only about France, it's also about Europe and the future of Europe. And then him being outside the country, some might see as such, but I mean, I personally am not very bothered, because this is what the heads of states do. They travel around the world.
I mean, James, looking at the disturbances in Paris in particular, is there a tendency among the news media in particular to get, frankly, over-invested in riots? Because you do get a lot of good pictures, yeah. and you can get some sort of outraged reactions from people. But, you know, I'm reminded a little bit of the riots across England in 2011. And this is obviously a much, much smaller event that's occurred in Paris the last few days. But I thought at the time that was massively overthought. I mean, people just like a punch-up, don't they?
Yeah, it's an editorial dilemma, really. You know, we say in British journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, any sort of violence will find its way into the headlines or to the top of the running orders. And there's a point at which, of course, you know, if you want to draw attention to your cause, or, you know, or whatever you want to do, you want to draw attention just to your activities, then go out and chuck a few bricks through the windows in Oxford Street or in the main street of Paris, and you're going to get covered much more than if you put some even inflammatory posts on Facebook or whatever. So I think there's an element of responsibility about the news media of saying, well, wait a minute, you know, this is not as significant as it might first seem. The riots here in 2011 were, you know, because they don't have that sort of disturbance, is not that common in London and other British cities, I suppose. They were covered more than they might have been in other countries. But again, you would expect, even if yesterday's events in Paris were larger than normal, this is something, you know, of a fairly normal occurrence in that sense, but perhaps made a little less usual by the fact that it's part of Macron's reform plans rather than just marking May Day.
And Stephanie, possibly at the risk of massively overthinking them, would anybody be going with the May 1968 angle here if this had happened in 2017 or if it happened in 2019? Because the other thing the media loves is an anniversary.
Yeah, but I think looking at now, I can't talk so much about the Paris riots, but the Berlin riots in the last years, they have become a happening. So you see kids from all over Germany traveling to Berlin to have a fun night out. And there was a lot of violence, but now it actually has become, I think the Council of Kreuzberg was quite clever to make it now an alternative love parade or something. So people come there, they're fun, they're drinking their beer on the streets, and it's just a very cool atmosphere. And then, of course, there come the, as you said, the hooded anarchists and try to enjoy the situation as they would like to enjoy it. And apparently that now the police has been very good in intelligence. They are filming everything, they're identifying people very quickly, and then people get arrested and get sentence for what they have been doing, and for now this has been working quite well. But you might also say, hey, what's going on in Germany? Why isn't there a bit more of a political riot?
Well, don't encourage them. we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Stephanie Bolton and James Rogers. Coming up next, what do you get a dead economic philosopher for his 200th birthday?
Monocle's May issue invites you to hang out with the world's brightest-eyed, bushiest-tailed new world leader. Jacinda Ardern is New Zealand's Prime Minister on a mission to turn her lively first 100 days in office into years of growth and good vibrations. Talking of which, we switch to California, dreaming of a modernist Mecca under cloudless skies, happy people in lovely homes. We're moving to LA, incidentally. Elsewhere, let us show you fauna. Dogs like this guy, coughing cartoons like these, porcelain pets, pussies, pilchards. We also suspend our disbelief with a visit to the studio of the artist and the set designer Ez Devlin, who's done big things for Adele and Beyoncé. We take five with jazz saviour Kamasi Washington, we sit pretty and count down our 50 favourite design innovations and marvel at Belgrade's Palace of Serbia and its marble rigour and surreal spotlessness. It's always a good time for a glass of something fortifying, of course, and so we have a vino with Adam Gopnik, hello Adam, a flirtini in Yokohama, and finish the bottle with these kiwis, and we're back to New Zealand then. Why are these suitcases smiling? Well, now you know why. Monocle's May issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
People are saying, look, enough is enough. The middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. The rich are getting richer. And they're saying, look, this is not a fair game.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
When tech companies have problems, they can go south very quickly. BlackBerry, Nokia, nowhere near the companies they used to be, but both were invincible. Nokia boasted that they were one of the first companies on the planet to sell 1 billion of their products.
And catch up with Monocle's Bureau around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister. With me are Stephanie Bolton and James Rogers. Now, this weekend, the burghers of the Moselle side town of Trier are preparing large-scale commemorations of the most, arguably the only, interesting thing to have occurred within the city limits. The birth 200 years ago this Saturday of Karl Marx, the economist and philosopher whose ideas would eventually lead to the imprisonment of half of Europe and the ideologically motivated slaughter of tens of millions of people around the world. Trier will be observing this ambiguous legacy with more than 600 events. The centrepiece, a 5.5-metre statue of Marx, donated by China. James, first of all, if you were the mayor of the town in which Karl Marx was born, would you be boasting about it?
If it might bring some tourists in to behave in a very capitalist rather than socialist manner and spend some money in my town for the weekend, I think perhaps I would. I mean, whatever one thinks of Marx, there's no question that he was very influential. And I think particularly in left-wing circles since the financial crisis of 2008, a lot of people have been dusting down his work and saying, see, look, he was right after all. So, yes, I think, you know, the town is right to celebrate it. And whatever one thinks of him, I mean, I think, and a lot of the coverage and the discussions about him at the moment are making this point that whatever one thinks of Marxist regimes, you know, to what extent can he be held responsible for the excesses of the early years of the Soviet Union or Cambodia or whatever?
Stephanie, is he thought of in Germany as a German historical figure? Because obviously he did most of his writing in London. His ideas first gained traction in Russia. And I guess, yeah, obviously half of Germany sort of was had those ideas imposed upon it at one point. But is he thought of as a German historical figure?
Exactly as you say, I think pretty much Germany is divided there. So if you were born and grew up in East Germany, of course Karl Marx was what you had to hear from morning to evening, whether it was at school or in kindergarten or at your work, and I don't think many people really liked what they were hearing because it was forcing them into a life many didn't like. And beyond that, of course, as you just said in the introduction, it made many millions of people suffer enormously. Then in West Germany, I should think for many he was almost like, yeah, the enemy of the people, because he was symbolizing something that was the right opposite of everything that the West wanted to be. But then again, I think in the last years, of course, it's far more acknowledged what role he had in history, his philosophical thoughts, the fundament he gave to economic and political thinking. So he is far more now acknowledged, I think, than he was maybe 10 years ago.
But just to follow that thought up, obviously, as we've been discussing, this is going to be a big deal in Trier, his birthplace. And okay, maybe fair enough, I'm not sure how big a tourist draw Trier usually is. But what will the rest of Germany be thinking? Will this be widely commemorated across the rest of the country or not?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe in what was Karl Marxstadt, remember Chemnitz, what is today Chemnitz in Saxonia, was called during the GDR Karl Marxstadt. I don't think, I mean, you will see in the political pages a lot of thought and very good and thoughtful pieces on Karl Marx and his legacy. I must say, I looked at pictures of this statue, you say?
Yes.
And it's absolutely horrendous. And it's really ugly, and it's 5.50 meters. But the worst thing about it, and I couldn't believe it, I mean, I know Trier quite well. It's a very nice little, quite squarish town on the Mosel. Excellent wine. It's a university town. It's very cozy, very nice, very German. But the main attraction in Trier is the Porta Negra, which is a huge city gate from the Roman times. It's impressive. It's beautiful. And they put this statue right in front of it. I can't believe if they had any sense in their mind, because they have the Karl Marx house. They have a lot of little squares. But to put it next to the main attraction of the town, I was really surprised.
James, the statue, as Stephanie correctly points out, is hideous and has been the subject of a certain measure of controversy. It obviously wasn't compulsory for Trier to accept this gift from China. And I think we have to factor in the possibility that the Chinese Communist Party are kind of winding everybody up here. But what was it wise to take the statue?
I think it's be quite rude to refuse, wouldn't it? It'd be one of those. I remember one former British Prime Minister being given a gift of a horse in the former Soviet Union, and a rather undiplomatic source saying that the Prime Minister didn't know what to do with it. You know, so I think sometimes when these gifts come from overseas, it's quite a sort of diplomatic conundrum, and I think they probably did have to accept it. Really, I mean, I think the point that Stephanie makes about the influence is really interesting. I mean, obviously, I spent many years in Russia, and I'm pretty sure that I'm writing saying that in Soviet times, in order to get any undergraduate university degree, you had to pass modules in Marxism-Leninism and the wonderfully named Scientific Communism. So if you didn't, even if you're studying
fun.
Physics or literature or whatever, and I also had the fortune to show how enduring his legacy was once to meet a very old gentleman in the early 1990s whose name was Mels. Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, and his parents, who I think he must have been born in the 20s or 30s. His parents had chosen the name, and that was his name.
Amazing. Stephanie, James sort of alluded earlier to the apology sort of usually made on Marx's behalf that, you know, it's not his fault that literally every regime that has ever tried to put his ideas into practice has more or less entirely ruined the country on which it was imposed. Is he sort of absolved, do you think? Can you actually detach the man from his ideas?
I think that very much depends on what political convictions you have. I mean, if you will, especially in Germany and especially in Berlin, where the legacy of the GDR and the Soviet times is very much present still. So, for example, the other day I went to the Stasi prison, which is now a museum in East Berlin. And you will find people there, for example, inmates who do the tours there. If you would ask them about Marx, I'm sure they still are very fiercely angry about what his legacy is. But then again, in Germany, or especially here in Britain, you find a lot of very young people who say his legacy is our future. So it is actually interesting that 200 years after his birth, he's such a very acutely controversial figure again.
Okay, well, finally tonight, to President Emmanuel Macron's visit to Australia, which we alluded to earlier, with all due respect to the fact that he speaks better English than most of my homeland's politicians speak French or English, he prompted some mirth when he thanked his host, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, for his hospitality, and as it turned out, more besides.
Thank you for your welcome. Thank you and your delicious wife for your warm welcome. It's the perfect organisation of this trip. Thanks to you and Lucy. Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister.
James, are we absolutely sure he misspoke there?
I'm not really sure, Andrew. No, I think was this a slip of the tongue or a Freudian slip? Indeed, I wonder. I mean, I think if one's going to be generous to Monsieur Macron, he was speaking his second language, which, as you rightly point out, he speaks extremely well. He might have been trying to say delightful, and it came out as delicious. Who knows? But I think, yes, he probably wishes he hadn't said that anyway.
I mean, Stephanie, I have a lot more sympathy than I used to for politicians misspeaking since I started spending quite a lot of my life talking into a microphone for a living. Because if you say things out loud in public long enough, you're going to do it sooner or later.
Yeah.
Do we make too much of a thing of it when politicians do this?
No, I mean, this one is, I find it actually very amusing, and I don't think, probably it's delightful. Although even, I must say, delightful would also, you wouldn't call it, I find it a bit sexist, actually, to say your wife is really delightful, because it puts her very much into the place of the decoration of the first, of the head of the state. But, I mean, there are so many lapses that happen, especially with radio hosts, with the famous health minister in this country. There have been a lot of misspoken about
Jeremy Hunt's name is tricky.
Yes.
But I think that's one of those things where the host gets into their head. It's just that voice saying, don't say, don't say, don't say, and there it is. I mean, James, I have to say, I'm a little bit disappointed as an Australian by our Prime Minister's reaction to this incident, because frankly, we've had one or two leaders down the years who just would have decked him.
Yeah, well, times change, Andrew, you know. this is the modern way of global diplomacy, I suppose. But I think Monsieur Macron does deserve some credit for not speaking his first language. I mean, I can think of very, very few native English speakers, Brits, Americans, Australians, and whoever, who have ever sort of had a go at speaking a foreign language, you know, or speaking more than a few sort of welcoming remarks.
But this is a weirdness that our countries share, though, as English-speaking islands, because, Stephanie, to you it would not seem at all remarkable if a politician speaks more than one language. In fact, it would seem normal. Whereas I can recall that when Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister of Australia, there was a certain amount of genuine suspicion about the fact that he spoke very good Chinese.
Yeah,
and, of course, John Kerry had to pretend he didn't speak French when he was running for President of the United States.
Yeah, for us it's something completely normal. I mean, all top politicians of a certain age, if they are older, then they will not speak languages so much. But, for example, Angela Merkel speaks fluent Russian and she speaks fluent English, and I don't know if she speaks French, but of course, when it comes to sensitive issues, when they have negotiations or whatever, they will always turn to their native language because it's too sensitive then. Mm. But Macron, he spoke last week, he spoke in the Congress, or was this week,
yes.
An amazing speech, all in English.
Yeah.
So, I mean, give him the credit that maybe he's great, also a little bit tired of travelling around speaking English.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Stephanie Boltson and James Rogers, thanks both very much for joining us. Today's edition of Midori House was produced by Ben Rylan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Melville. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thank you for listening.